It's Wednesday, October 21st. One was first on the scene, the other had final say on charges. Neither had spoken in public until now. We start here. In an ABC News exclusive, an officer describes what happened the night Breonna Taylor was killed.
This is not relatable to a George Floyd. This is nothing like it. It's not an Ahmaud Arbery. It's nothing like it.
And yet on the same day, a grand juror reveals what charges they were and weren't told to consider. That thing that's basically hardwired into practically every phone in the world might be illegal.
Google is kind of like Kleenex. It's ubiquitous.
The U.S. government just filed a monster lawsuit against Google. And 7 months after they began the fight of their lives, healthcare workers are still making room for more bodies.
Crime, fatigue, stress.
We'll take you to El Paso, Texas, to show you what a third wave looks like up close. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. There are certain parts of the criminal justice system that seem like a black box. A grand jury case seems like a black box, right? You know, prosecutors go in seeking an indictment, and then out on the other side, they get it, or rarely, they don't. But what happened in between is largely kept secret. In many cases, the moment a crime occurs is also a black box. Unless everything's documented, it's hard to really know exactly what happened.
Breonna Taylor!
Especially if the victim is dead.
Anger, unrest nationwide after that grand jury decision to decline charging those three officers in the fatal shooting, 26-year-old EMT Breonna Taylor in her own home, Michael.
And for months now, people in Louisville, Kentucky have been frustrated by this nagging feeling that following the killing of an innocent woman in a nighttime shootout, the only people who would ever truly know what really happened were there in these rooms. Well, yesterday, new light was shined into each of them.
All right, we're going to get right into it.
All right.
In a collaboration between ABC News and the Courier-Journal newspaper in Louisville, one of the police officers involved in that fateful shooting of Breonna Taylor gave an exclusive interview. And on the same day he gave his story, some of the grand jurors who heard the case later, they were cleared to give their stories. There were two teams interviewing this officer, ABC's own Michael Strahan, the co-anchor of Good Morning America, and the Courier-Journal's Tessa Duvall, since the Breonna Taylor case has basically become her full-time beat lately. We've got her with us now. Tessa, thanks for being with us. This was Officer Jonathan Mattingly that you guys spoke to, right? He was on the team serving the warrant. What does he say happened?
That's right. We spoke with Sergeant Jonathan Mattingly of the Louisville Metro Police Department. And his story is much like the one that he told investigators a few weeks after the shooting back in March.
So we get up. I remember banging on the door. It's open hand, hard smacks, bam, 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 bam.
He got to the door. He knocked and he knocked and he knocked.
I yelled, "Please search warrant. Please search warrant. You're yelling this."
And no one came to the door. No one answered. You know, he felt like, you know, they gave Breonna Taylor and later they found out Kenny Walker, her boyfriend, was inside with her, but feels like they gave her more than enough time to get to the door.
To not give people time to formulate a plan, not give people time to get their senses so they have an idea of what they're doing. Because if that had happened, I'm telling you, Mike, if that had happened, Breonna Taylor would be alive.
You believe she'd be alive
100%.
If that had happened? If you had just stormed in.
Yes.
And so he's knocking and he's knocking. And finally, they decide to use the battering ram and force entry into this apartment. And, you know, that's when he sees Kenny Walker and Breonna Taylor down the hall and is shot once in his leg. And, you know, that is very much the same story that he told to investigators, you know, months ago.
I feel for her. I hurt for her mother, for her sisters. It's not just a passing, oh, this is part of the job, we did it, move on. It's not like that. I mean, Breonna Taylor is now attached to me for the rest of my life. And that's not, again, woe is me. That's me feeling for them.
But I think really one of the strengths of this joint interview that we did is that it was also the first time to get his reaction to everything that has unfolded over these last few months. You know, he has had to essentially sit in silence with a lot of this. And he's had a lot to say about what's unfolded since then.
Yeah, walk me through that, because I know that you and Michael Strahan both wanted to get his take on the aftermath, and he appeared to say this is like fundamentally different from like the George Floyd case in Minnesota.
Right. That is a really clear distinction that he wanted to draw.
There have been marches. There have been protests. What was your feelings watching all that unfold after this?
Mostly frustration, because there was so much disinformation out. All these false narratives, because this is not relatable to a George Floyd. This is nothing like it. It's not an Ahmaud Arbery. It's nothing like it. It's not a race thing like people want to try to make it to be. It's not. This is a fact. This is a point where we were doing our job. We return fire. This is not us going hunting somebody down. This is not kneeling on a neck. This is nothing like that.
You know, what happened to George Floyd was not good police work. That no officer he knows looks at that and said, yeah, that's how that should have played out. But when he looks at the warrant execution, he doesn't see that same misconduct.
Like, to him, this is still by the book.
Right. You know, he wrote this email about a month or so ago to his colleagues and said that they did the legal, moral, and ethical thing. And by that, you know, he meant we are police officers doing our jobs. We were there to, and as a part of this narcotics investigation, we want to get drugs off the street. And we didn't act with the intent to kill this woman. We acted to protect ourselves.
It wasn't me out there playing cowboy and being out of control. I mean, we were asked to do a job, a task. We were doing the job.
And so he feels like what happened to George Floyd and what happened to Breonna Taylor are apples and oranges, and that it's not fair to compare the two.
For the first time, we're hearing from a grand juror in the Breonna Taylor case, a judge granting them permission to speak freely late today.
It's just fascinating. On the same day, this officer is telling you he's being judged unfairly by a lot of people who weren't there. You also have a grand juror come out and say, like, they didn't really get a chance to judge him properly, that they weren't able to consider charges against him.
Again, this is about what the grand jury decided.
Right. So we know that the attorney general said initially that the grand juror agreed with his office's assessment that because Sergeant Mattingly, as well as Detective Miles Cosgrove, acted in self-defense once they were fired upon.
According to Kentucky law, the use of force by Mattingly and Cosgrove was justified to protect themselves. This justification bars us from pursuing criminal charges in Miss Breonna Taylor's death.
One juror releasing a statement saying the grand jury was not presented any charges other than the three wanton endangerment charges against Detective Hankison.
And what we've now heard, because one of these grand jurors, through their attorney, has spoken out after getting the court's permission to do so, we now know that grand jurors weren't given the chance to weigh in on whether they acted in self-defense or not.
Adding that they did not have homicide offenses explained to them.
You know, they didn't necessarily agree the way that Attorney General Daniel Cameron said that they did.
So then at the end of this, Tessa, because you've been living this, right? You've been at the protests, you've been covering the court side of it. Where does this leave Louisville and the people who are, you know, who have been in the streets, who feel like they just cannot trust the institutions involved here?
Yeah. You know, there's a sense among some people who are perhaps, you know, kind of less invested in this, you know, that aren't out on the streets every day the way that, you know, protesters in the city are, that, okay, we've had these big milestones, right? Like, we've had the civil settlement, we've had the grand jury indictment, and now things are going to slow down.
I'm disappointed, but I wasn't surprised. And I'm very clear that justice was not served today.
But I think, to your point, there are so many people in this community who feel not just that what happened in the Breonna Taylor case and everything since is unsatisfactory, they also feel like there are still bigger fish to fry.
Not only ending no-knock warrants, but mandating that officers have their body cameras on when they issue a warrant and before and afterwards, and that they submit to alcohol and drug testing when they're involved in a deadly shooting or a violent incident.
There are still more reforms. There's more cultural change within LMPD that needs to be worked on. There's still inequities in the community that still need to be addressed. And so while Breonna Taylor's death certainly ignited this movement,
fill them up, raise them high, put your fist in the sky.
The movement has become much bigger than justice in this singular case. It's It's justice for a community.
Yeah, and it was just fascinating to watch this kind of bizarre back and forth yesterday in real time. By the way, you can hear this full interview between Michael Strahan and this officer on Good Morning America today. Tessa Duvall from the Courier-Journal. Great reporting. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, if you look up the phrase antitrust, you're getting a ton of new search results this morning. Back after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Washington has had lots of questions for the tech industry in recent years. Lots of hearings, even frustration.
Why does Google steal content from honest businesses?
Mr. Chairman, with respect, I disagree with that characterization.
Well, yesterday, the Department of Justice filed an actual lawsuit against Google.
The Justice Department accusing the tech giant of being a monopoly gatekeeper for the internet. Google handles nearly 90% of what Americans are searching for on the internet.
And this lawsuit is perhaps the biggest we've seen against a tech company in 20 years. Let's bring in ABC's chief technology and business correspondent, Rebecca Jarvis. Rebecca, what is the government alleging about Google here?
Hi, Brad. Well, the crux of this is that Google has become ubiquitous with search, and it is the search engine that everyone is using to search the internet, to search advertising markets, and their point here is that it's monopolistic.
Google unlawfully maintains these monopolies through a web of exclusionary and interlocking agreements that shut out competitors.
Now, if you think about it, there aren't really that many other options that come to mind. If you wanted to go out right now and search for something on your phone or your computer, you probably would Google it. And Google is kind of like Kleenex. It's ubiquitous for this because there aren't those other options. Yes, there's Bing. Yes, there's DuckDuckGo. Right. But for the most part, these are all pre-installed. And that's one of the big things that the DOJ is saying here.
Google collectively pays mobile phone manufacturers, carriers, and web browsers billions of dollars each year from its monopoly search advertising revenues. to be the preset default search engine.
You have a Google Chrome app pre-installed on your phone. You have it pre-installed on your computer. And their point is that that's anti-competitive. That's keeping other alternatives out of the market. And that's not good for consumers.
Okay, so I was going to say, because it doesn't seem like it should be against the law just to make a company that everyone really, really
likes
and uses.
That's very successful, yes.
Right. You're saying, like, it wouldn't be illegal to build a search engine that everyone likes. It wouldn't be illegal to make your own operating system or have your own phones. The government says it's illegal to do all of those things at once. Is that the gist?
Right. And also because of the various, the Department of Justice case is also about the various agreements it's entered into, the exclusivity agreements that forbid pre-installation of any kind of competing search service. They have other arrangements that force pre-installation of its applications in prime locations on mobile devices. They have these long-term agreements with Apple that require Google to be the default and the de facto exclusive general search engine.
Prosecutors alleging the ties were so deep, a senior Apple official wrote, "Our vision is that we work as if we are one company."
That means that they are the most used search engine. But Google's argument here is, yeah, we built this incredible product and people are using Google and this incredible product because they choose to, not because they're forced to or because they can't find alternatives.
Larry Kudlow, the director of the U.S. National Economic Council, was asked about the suit.
We have been consulting with Justice. The president has. And senior staff. And it's an important case to explore.
I'm wondering, like, is there a timing element here to consider, Rebecca? Because the Trump administration and the tech world, like, they're both about to be center stage with the election this close. But is this something we also would have seen in an Obama or a Bush administration?
There has been bipartisan agreement over looking into all major tech companies. And there's just growing interest, I think, Brad, in understanding these things. Yes, some might find the timing suspicious, but the reality here is these are companies that in the last 15 years, Google, Apple, now Facebook, Yelp, they have more power over our lives. And there's much more focus on these companies as a result of that. This is really the first time that we've seen anything along these lines since the Microsoft case. And a lot of experts will look at the Microsoft antitrust case, which happened about 20 years ago, as you say. That was really about a monopoly where they were able to charge higher prices because they were the only game in town.
No consumer should be denied the browser of its choice because Microsoft made their computer vendor an offer that the vendor couldn't refuse.
Well, in this case, it's a free product, but they have huge power over our world, over what we see, and that's becoming more and more of a political question as well, and also a question for how we want to live our lives in the future.
DOJ is asking a judge to rule that Google violated antitrust laws, and that could lead to the company being broken into smaller pieces. Today, Google responded saying the lawsuit is deeply flawed and would do nothing to help consumers.
Nobody expects this to be quickly resolved. This is a long-term lawsuit. This will not be decided in months. It will be decided over the course of years. Mm. And one of the things that consumers should keep in mind is that there might not be that much recourse that you will feel as a consumer. In fact, it might just be the fact that as a result of this, no, Google can no longer preload this onto your phone or your computer.
You got to download an extra app. All right. That's potentially the biggest thing that might come out of this is if you just had your head in the sand. All right, Rebecca Jarvis, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Brad.
If you had wondered whether deaths had been overcounted in the COVID-19 pandemic, well, consider this. The CDC is able to pretty reliably predict every year how many people will die. Because every year, it looks almost the same. It's this wave that gently rises in the winter, gets lower in the summer. Well, this year, if you look at the graphs, you see deaths go way higher than their expected number in April. They come down a little, but then they stay above that average line for months. In fact, if you look at this report from yesterday, they're still there, likely because of the coronavirus. And while the official COVID death toll is a staggering 220,000, the deaths above that expected line are even higher. They're approaching 300,000.
Nearly 1 million new cases in the U.S. just since the start of this month. Hospitalizations on the rise in 42 states now.
And it's unclear where those extra deaths would be coming from. But we know two things. One, the current death toll is not an overcount by any stretch, and two, deaths are accelerating again. ABC's chief national correspondent Matt Gutman is in one of the nation's hottest hotspots right now, El Paso, Texas. Matt, what's it like there?
I'll paint a picture for you, Brad. Yesterday evening, I was at a testing site. It's two big white tents, dozens of people administering tests. There were four lanes of cars. It went for a mile. The line lasted 4 hours.
So in the last 2 weeks, we have seen a very sharp increase in positive cases to about 500% increase.
A 500% increase.
We were in the low 100s.
That's just here in El Paso, where the number of cases has increased 500% since 2 weeks ago. That is an astronomical rise, and that means it is going to continue to rise, and there's a cascade of eventualities.
Would you say that you're in the surge right now?
Definitely. We are definitely in a surge.
What does that look like inside?
Busy.
Higher number of cases means more hospitalizations, means more people in ICUs, means more people on ventilators, and it means more deaths. And we are already starting to see that play out at funeral homes here.
Sunset Funeral Homes recently installing three mortuary refrigerators at their west and east locations.
They have purchased large refrigerator units ahead of this surge. They expect that within 21 to 25 days, they are going to be, quote, overwhelmed. They are already seeing higher numbers than they've ever seen.
And what's the capacity?
A capacity could hold up to maybe 80 cases.
Well, and that's what I'm wondering, Matt. Like, if you're a medical professional who has dropped everything to save your fellow citizens, but you did that like in April, what is it like on the floors of these hospitals where you're seeing these numbers swelling again?
So there's massive burnout.
So your eyes are a little red.
Yes.
Is that from crying? Is that from fatigue?
That's, I'll be honest, probably a little bit of everything. Crying, fatigue, stress, lack of sleep, emotionally drained.
You know, this nurse we spoke to, Vanessa Hidalgo, she's been doing this 7 months.
You mean they're coming in sicker?
Oh, yes, by far.
She's a mom. When she goes home, her kid knows not to hug her because she is, quote unquote, contaminated. She's got to shower first. This is a 2-year-old who's already aware.
And that was like novel back in April. I can't imagine this going on that long.
I can't imagine it either.
So
you weren't used to seeing so many people die?
No, of course not. And I think, you know, we're human. Our emotions get to us. Sorry. It's just hard to see.
And she says she sometimes goes into the office and has to cry. She cries with her husband. She cries with her kids. She cries with her patients because it is so overwhelming.
I do want to continue to underscore the serious situation that we're in here in Wisconsin.
And speaking about nurses and doctors in these communities, they are part of the community.
And you'll remember back in March and April, we all stayed home to flatten the curve and protect our frontline healthcare workers and hospitals. It's important to understand that we're in a much worse place now than we were in March and April.
And with the numbers surging as they are nationwide, but especially in the nation's midsection, what's going to happen is people are going to get sick. Nurses and doctors are going to get sick. And it's going to be hard to replace them because the nation right now is so strapped for traveling nurses and doctors and people who can specialize in ICU units. So we are potentially headed for some serious trouble, not just the death count and the rising numbers, but there is going to be possibly a very critical shortage in doctors and nurses within the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, and it made me think last night at the World Series, Matt, they did this really nice first pitch ceremony for medical professionals. And you think what they really want is probably not that. It's probably just for people to stop giving COVID to each other in this third wave. Matt Gutman in El Paso, Texas. Thanks.
Thanks, Brad.
And one last thing. So where are you as we speak then right now?
I am at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. We have an office here.
That's ABC's Gina Sinceri. She's based in Houston, and she is ABC's go-to producer for covering outer space. So it's rare that she sees something truly brand new.
We're going in.
You could see everyone wanted to hug each other, but they couldn't because it's a pandemic, darn it. But they were jumping up and down.
Touchdown declared.
All right.
So here's what happened. Last night, a NASA spacecraft named OSIRIS-REx did something we have never done before. It approached a moving asteroid hurtling through space, lowered itself to the asteroid's surface, touched down, and then took off again in what they call a touch and go.
OSIRIS-REx never really landed on the asteroid Bennu. What it did is it slowly deorbited, slower than we walk, 0.2 miles an hour.
There's giant boulders all around the Nightingale site, even some large rocks inside the crater that we do not think the spacecraft would survive, at least with the ability to return back to Earth if it made contact.
And it reached its robotic arm out, and then it just snatched a little bit of the asteroid, and then it backed away. So it was called a tag for touch and go.
Sample collection is complete, and the back away burn has executed.
All right.
Gina, I know this. Like, I've heard of this before, where the U.S. government says, hey, there's an asteroid out there. We need to go to it. We're going to land a rocket on it. Then that rocket is going to leave and come back to Earth. That's the movie Armageddon.
Everybody hang on. This could get a little rough.
Well, it's very similar to the movie Armageddon, except no humans on this rocket. NASA's flirted with sending people to an asteroid for a long time.
The clues to how everything around us began, from the formation of the planets to the beginning of life itself, may be locked up in these asteroids.
And Gina says there are more parallels here than you think, because the premise of this mission was, look, there are literally thousands of asteroids flying by us every year. Bennu is one of them. So scientists wanted to know, if we ever needed to deflect one, or maybe blow it up, what's it made out of? That question was worth 10 years of planning and 7 years of flight time. All for a 5-minute window last night where our spacecraft was able to grab a hunk of asteroid and bring it back to Houston.
And this is where that little sample, it's the size of a candy bar, by the way, that will...
Wait, the asteroids, the asteroid stuff is the size of a candy bar?
The sample that they grabbed is about the size of a candy bar.
Congratulations. How are you guys feeling?
Transcendental. I mean, I can't believe we actually pulled this off.
Gina was telling me it will go in the same vault nearby her as the moon rocks. Space, you guys. Space. Remember, you can always check in with us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We are at Start Here ABC. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.